to kick off with, I'm going to actually take you on a journey through time. I do hope you'll come with me and enjoy it. And in that process, you'll hear a bit about the Timescape study, what we've been doing. But I want to sort of go back to the sort of conceptual foundations for the work that we do, really, and talk a bit about that. So, journey through time. So, I want to think in the next little while about time, both as a conceptual category, but as a methodological strategy. And it's an important medium. It's not just the medium through which we do research. It's an important topic in its own right. And that's one of the things I want to get hold of. So what I'll try to do as we're talking sort of conceptually is make that link between, if you like, theory and method, which is often quite difficult to grasp. And in that process, I'm going to try and draw a closer and more productive alignment between two parallel fields of inquiry. We have social theories of time on one hand, and then we have much more empirically based longitudinal and life course studies. And at the moment, these two bodies of scholarship don't really interact. So that's quite interesting in itself, how we might draw some link between the two. And it's through qualitative longitudinal methods that we can create that link. So just to go back to basics then, what is qualitative longitudinal research? Very simple definition here. It is qualitative inquiry conducted through or in relation to time. And I want to tease out those two dimensions, the qualitative and then the temporal. Forgive me, you'll all be very familiar with all of this. Qualitative inquiry, through that method we're generating very rich, detailed, textured data about individuals and linked lives using an array of interview and ethnographic and narrative methods. And what we're doing through that is discerning social practices and subjective experiences, identities, beliefs, emotions and values and so on. We can derive meanings from context and complexity and produce, therefore, very fine-grained understandings about the world. And really important, we can address those really important how and why questions. So, I mean, all research would claim to have explanatory power, but I think this has significant explanatory power. And in this process, because we're able to deal with subjective experience, we can authenticate personal lives and human agency. Human agency, that capacity to act and interact and influence the shape of an individual life, our own lives, and indeed the lives of others. But in saying that, I just want to be clear, we're not saying that agency is all and that we're going to ignore structure. Obviously, the two and how they're interrelated is, you know, is central to much of what we do. But in this method, we put human agency, I think, at the heart of inquiry. Okay, so that's the qualitative dimension. And now we do all of that, and we're doing it through and in relation to time. So what we're able to do is explore the temporal dimension of experience, change, continuity, endurance, transition, causality, subjective causality, and therefore we can illuminate how change is actually created and lived and experienced. We can shed light on all kinds of microprocesses and the causes and consequences of change or continuity in the social world. Because in this day and age, there's a growing need to understand the lived experience of change and continuity, how change occurs, and the agency of individuals in shaping or accommodating to these processes. And I'll just say a little bit more about, you know, the basics for this, going back to time. And this is something I wrote with my colleague, Jennifer Flowerdew. It is through time that we can begin to grasp the nature of social change. It is indeed only through time that we can gain a better appreciation of how the personal and social agency and structure, the micro and macro, are interconnected and how they come to be transformed. Because the relationship between the two is essentially dynamic. You know, we have this sociological conundrum about the relationship between agency and structure, but once you add time into the mix, suddenly you have a mechanism for understanding how that relationship can work and is worked out over time. And much of this I'm talking about now isn't new. It goes back to the work of C. Wright Mills in his sociological imagination. And it's spawned, actually, it's C. Wright Mills who spawned much of this kind of scholarship that we're doing now. And he said, we cannot hope to understand society unless we have a prior understanding of the relationship between biography and history. The task is to continually work out and revise your views on the problems of history, the problems of biography, and the problems of social structure in which biography and history intersect. Now, it's a wonderful starting point for so many people currently doing this kind of work, but C. Wright Mills didn't say how to go about it. You know, how are we going to link biography and history? So we've been grappling with that one ever since. Just a word here, you know, I'm talking here about, you know, very much at the conceptual level, but QL inquiry has enormous policy relevance. It's a really good tool for policy. Understanding processes of change is important in policy contexts where individuals or organisations are required to change their behaviour or adapt to changing environments. And if you want to follow up those sorts of ideas, if you go to, there's a special issue of Social Policy and Society published in 2007. I do have a bibliography list here, by the way, and there'll be one on the web for you to refer to. But that special issue deals with content technology research in social policy contexts. So it's basic for that idea. It's also, this method can be used as a tool for tracking what happens to organisations, new initiatives, policy initiatives, as they're unfolding on the ground. It can be a very, very practical tool for navigating processes of change in policy contexts. Just a word now about research design before we say a bit more about time. There are several kind of basic designs, but the nub of it really is a prospective design, which is tracking individuals or groups. We like to think of it as walking alongside people as their lives unfold. And you can do that in different ways. So in other words, you're doing your research in real time as things happen. We can do extensive tracking over many, many years. I don't know if any of you know of the 7UP TV program, or you've seen it. This was a documentary program started in the 1950s by a chap called Michael Apted, an ITV documentary, which looked at the lives of a number of seven-year-olds from different social backgrounds. So with children that were living in children's homes and those from very wealthy backgrounds in private school. And then having made that program, and he was very, very much an innovator because he interviewed these young people and got their views on their lives. Now, to do that in the 1950s for childhood was really innovative. And what he's done is created a documentary on the lives of those young people every 7 years since. And it's absolutely fascinating to see what's happened to them. They're all now 50. And ones that you thought maybe would have a wonderful life and sort of dipped down, and others that you thought were not going to start from anywhere have come up. You know, it's really fascinating. So that's how you can do a very extensive kind of tracking. But also you can do intensive tracking through particular experiences or policy contexts. Now, this idea of longitudinal might just be a bit of a misnomer because people tend to think that longitudinal has to be over long periods of time. But actually, you can do a micro study, which is tracking an individual or a group through a particular process just over a few months, and that is valid. You might be able to capture a particular piece of micro history. So, for example, in Timescapes, in our studies here, we decided to ask all of our 400 or so participants about their responses to recession hitting, which was a couple of years ago. So there's a moment in time, what was going on for the people going through this, and you know, and we got an awful lot out of that process just by you know, in a short period of time, seeing what was happening, a kind of snapshot in time, what was happening for people. So if you wanted to ask that question, as some people well, quite often people ask me, how long does it have to be to make it longitudinal? And there is no right answer to that. Depends, of course, on your research question, if you're doing question-led research. Okay, so that's prospective designs. And then we have retrospective designs, where primarily what we're doing is looking back in time, revisiting the past through the lens of the present day. So, you know, life history methods, oral histories, and so on. And one of the advantages of that is that you can just go out into the field once, so it's a bit cheaper to fund that kind of research. But you're only getting the past timeline then. Okay? And of course, these are not mutually exclusive ways of researching. You can do prospective work and retrospective. You can, you know, visit people again and again, looking back and looking forward. So you're combining them. I'll just say a word about historical revisiting studies. And these are studies of particular communities or organisations where you're not tracking the same individuals necessarily over time. Just some examples here. There are three studies, Graham Crow, Julia Johnson, Nick Charles. Julia Johnson did a follow-up of a very famous piece of research called The Last Refuge, written by Peter Townsend. And The Last Refuge was a study of old people's homes in the 1960s. And it's a searing indictment of what we were doing to older people in the 1960s. Okay? And all these years later, Julia came along to find out what had happened to all those old people's homes that Peter Townsend had studied.
So it's a very, very interesting study.
Nikki Charles, she's a kinship researcher. It was a very famous study called A Kinship in a South Wales Town, done by Rosser and Harris in the 1950s. And Nikki Charles went back to that same South Wales town to find out what was happening to kinship in the new millennium. So you can see how you can do this historical revisiting, and it's a different way of working through time. But one of the things I want to pull out of all this is that when we're using QL methods, we're using, you know, they're very flexible and they're creative and they're innovative. So for example, if you're tracking people over time, you can allow the findings from one wave of interviews to inform the next. You don't know where you're going because you don't know where your people are going, so you follow them. Okay, I'm going to get back to time now, how we conceptualise it. And I really like this idea from Richard Bertou. He says, longitudinal data offers a movie rather than a snapshot. And I think it's a very good metaphor for what we're doing. Okay, but there are different ways of creating that movie. And here I want to just say a bit about how you might think about time in a quantitative frame. You know, we have our large-scale panel and cohort studies, and in those studies, time is linear and cumulative and invariably moving forward. So time emerges in these kind of studies as chronology and sequence and duration and interval. And to give you some examples from Liesering and Walker's book, The Dynamics of Modern Society, there are two chapters in that book that are looking at the spells of time that individuals spend in a particular state. The time that people might spend in a state of unemployment, for example, or cohabitation. And they're really interesting and, you know, it's very solid pieces of work showing, for example, that people don't stay in cohabiting relationships very long. They come out of them. They either go back into singlehood or they convert the cohabitation into a marriage. But cohabitation then becomes a very temporary phase for most people. So that's how you might be looking at duration and interval and so on. So in these particular studies, time is linked to trend data. What you're doing is generating that very long shot, the bird's eye view, the very broad vista of society. So if you go back to that movie metaphor, the kind of movie you're creating is your grand epic movie, a very important movie to have. But when we think about qualitative concepts of time, this is rather more what we get, a kaleidoscopic view of social life, and much more difficult to unpick in some ways. So we can conceptualize qualitatively concepts of time. They're complex flows of time or time space, and that's where we get the title of our particular study from. And time in this kind of paradigm it's fluid, it's multidimensional, it's very varied. It may encompass biography and generation and history and industrial time, cyclical time, the passage of the seasons and what that means as we measure our progress through life. And of course, what emerges out of all of that is that we see time as a social construct. And, you know, I recommend that you go and look at the work of Barbara Adam in particular for those sorts of ideas. So in this framework, time is linked to the textures of real lives. It generates a very grounded view of individuals and groups. We get very interested in individual storylines. We want to know what happens next, what are the twists and turns in people's lives, and the intricacies of people's lives, and the interior logic of their lives. So if you go back to the movie metaphor, this is the up-close and personal movie. And it's not to say, of course, that this is a better movie. We need both kinds of movie, the grand epic and the up-close and personal. But we certainly do need the up-close and personal movie to emerge. I'll just say a word here about temporal understandings of the life course. The life course is a very important framework which we use when we're thinking through time. And you can see some variations in the way that the life course is thought about and conceptualised, depending on whether you're a quantitative or a qualitative researcher. The traditional way of viewing the life course was as the life cycle, okay? Very much as a structured mechanism, predefined series of life stages through which everybody passes, the benchmarks against which people measure development and behaviour, and indeed not simply measure, but often evaluate people's behaviour as well. And you can see that, for example, in some classic works such as Piaget and Kalberg, who were looking at the stages that children pass through. And one of them posited that there were 6 stages, and another one 8 stages of childhood. And more recently, Richard Virtue has suggested that there are 8 stages that people pass through throughout their life. Okay? So these become the structured stages, and then of course everything else becomes a little bit deviant from the main stages. But another way of looking at it is to say that the life course is the negotiation of a passage through an unpredictably changing environment. And Holstein and Gubriam have said the life course does not simply unfold before and around us, rather we actively organise the flow, pattern and direction of experience as we navigate the social terrain of everyday lives. So here, of course, you've got a much more qualitative view with human agency, subjective experience right in there. Some more definitions, which I will leave for today. I want to go over some key concepts that we use when we think about time in a qualitative frame now. I've talked about biography and history and generation, and I want to say a little bit about those three. They are the key ways which we have framed time in timescapes and looking at the relationship between biography and history and generation. So biographical time, this is an individual life that flows through the lifespan from birth to death and is shaped by and interacts with a multitude of personal and relational and historical events. And I really like the idea of Prue Chamberlain's of life journeys. You know, if you think about the life journeys that people have, life journeys of individuals, but also the collective biographies of groups or organisations. And if you know, for example, that an individual moves from point A to point B, so going back to that example I gave earlier, cohabitation, you know that so many people will go into cohabitation and then they'll come out of it. What triggers a change in direction? Was it an active choice of people? Or were they pushed into making that particular change in life? And what's the nature of that journey along the way? It's really important to get to those sort of dynamic processual ways of looking at how people move from A to B. In fact, it goes back to that idea of the Odyssey, really, which is that the nature of the journey is just as important as the destination that you reach. Very important. And, of course, these are all lovely theoretical ideas about biography. What do we do about that if we're going to create a methodological strategy out of it? Well, in the field, we can work with ideas such as critical moments and epiphanies and turning points. These are ideas that have come from the work of Denzin and Giddens and my colleagues, Janet Holland and Rachel Thompson. So we can find out from people, we can ask them about particular turning points and be amazed at the kinds of things that they say, which has created a particular change in their lives. And then we've got historical time. I'm going back here to C. Wright Mills, his ideas of linking biography and history. Historical time, how individuals locate themselves in different epochs and in relation to external conditions and events, and including, of course, shifting policy landscapes. So here you're looking at the intersection of historical time with critical moments in individual biographies. And of course, we can capture historical time, as I've already said, through our longitudinal studies, oral and life histories, but also through intergenerational research. So just for example, I have some colleagues at Leeds, Mark Priestley and Sonali Shah, and they did a wonderful story of disability through the life course. And they had three cohorts of disabled people. The first cohort was born in the 1940s, and then there was another cohort born in the 1970s, I think, and then a later cohort born in the 1990s. And in each case, they were asking those people about their journeys through childhood and into adulthood. And of course, that was a really good way of capturing historical time, because they were able to see the changes in educational policy for disabled people, how some of them have been subject to special education away from the mainstream, and then the changing policies enabling people to be part of the mainstream, and so on. So, okay, historical time. And then I was saying to you, we need a link between biography and history, and we might want to think of that, if you like, as a relational field in between. You've got your micro and your macro, and you need a meso level in between. In our field, in family research, which is what Timescapes is largely about, we use the concept of generational time. Okay, that's our relational meso level of thinking about things. And if you think about generation, you can think of individuals as part of a generational convoy, and you can think about that in two ways. Through family and kinship groups, and this comes from the work of people like Tamara Haraven. And in that kind of frame, generation is aligned vertically through time. So, you know, there's you, and then above you, there's the older generation, your parents and grandparents, and below you, coming up, there are your children and your grandchildren. Okay, so that's a thinking of, you know, how we relate to people in an intergenerational sense. And then we have the sense of age sets or cohorts, and that's thinking about generation in the Mannheim sense. And these are aligned horizontally through time, and this is us going through life with our generational cohort, and, you know, seeing what happens to a particular cohort of people, an age cohort of people. And sometimes those age cohorts take on a particular identity of their own. So we have the war generation, the baby boom generation, and so on, the beach generation. It's also interesting, I was just going to say, if you want to follow up this idea of generations, go and have a look at Judith Burnett's wonderful book called Generations. If you think about generational categories such as child and adult and old age, they're very fluid and shifting as people cross generational boundaries and as life course categories expand and contract. So, you know, adolescence now is very, very long. You know, when does it stop? Well, we don't quite know. Old age is also an expanding category. And in the middle, you have sort of middle-aged people, rather like me, who get a bit squished in the middle. But there you go. Again, you can think about generational time. We can do intergenerational research, such as the work I've described that Mark and Sonali have done, but also Julia Brannan, who's done a wonderful study on four-generation families. And again, by interviewing people across the generation, she's able to pick up on historical changes going on, interdependence and so on through generations. I just want to say a little bit about other different ways in which you can conceptualise time when you're thinking qualitatively, and just bring in the work of Jane Limke, who is an American educationist, and he talks about time scales. And actually what he does, he sets out a lovely big chart, and at the top of the chart you have the passing of the ages, the eons, the ice age, the iron age, okay? And what he says is that up at this top end of the chart, time moves so immeasurably slowly that you cannot possibly comprehend it. And then at the bottom end of the chart, you have the microscopic changes that occur within our bodies. And at that bottom end of the chart, time moves so immeasurably fast that we cannot possibly comprehend it. And then in between, you've got all sorts of other timescales going on. And we are simultaneously inhabiting all of those timescales. We are part of an eon. But goodness knows what that eon is, because it's too big for us to grasp. Okay? But what I draw out of Lemke's work is the importance of exploring the pace of change, the velocity of change, how we sustain things and bide our time as much as how we change things. Okay, we might want to think about short-term horizons and then long-term horizons. You know, because some people live very much in the present. Other people have got a life plan. So this makes us think again of these different ways of using time horizons. I just want to give you one practical example, which I very much like from one of the Timescapes projects. And this is Joanna Bornat and Bill Bytheway, who did a lovely study called The Oldest Generation in Timescapes. They had funding to track around about 12 people over the age of 75 to see what happened to them in older life. In fact, we had quite a bit of difficulty getting funding for this particular project because the funders said that the people will die. What does this do for sample maintenance? And we said, well, the whole point is to, you know, try and capture experiences at the end of life. And in fact, two of their sample did die. But the methods that they used with the older people were life history interviews. So they were looking back over a long life. And out of those life history interviews, very, very interesting, because people, when they look back in that kind of way, will often have a very positive gloss on their life. They've survived, their survivals, you know, their survival stories. So they're very, very positive. At the same time, they also used diary methods. And they had a recorder working with that older person to help them record their life on a weekly basis. And those diaries revealed a very, very different picture. Okay, so they were embedded rather more in the micro changes in the here and now. So one day somebody might have decided that they're going to have to move into a residential home, and the next day they decide they can't possibly do that. The next day they may have a fall. Life becomes very contingent.
when you're older. Okay, and that's what they were able to pick up on. And they, by bringing the diaries and the life histories into to talk to each other, they could reveal all these different ways in which the older people lived in time. Another interesting concept, chronotopes, or the intersection of time and space, and this comes from the work of Bakhtin, who's a literary theorist, a Russian literary theorist in the 1930s. But what Bakhtin makes us think about is the connection between temporal and spatial relationships. If you think about it, whenever anything happens in the world, we have to locate it. And the first thing we want to know is, where did it happen? And when did it happen? Okay? So I think these are really important mechanisms for grasping the meaning and significance of events. And I have to say, because we're still very much grappling with the whole temporal landscape here, there's very little research that's currently going on that is looking across time and space. An open field if anything wants to, you know, move into a terrain that very few researchers have trod. And of course, this is the last way of thinking through time, which I think is just so important, is the relationship between past and present and future. We are all living only in the present, but in the present, we are always aware of a past that is informing our present lives and a future which is also informing our present lives. We can think about it as hindsight and foresight and insight. And the past, and I've referred to this a number of times already, but it's a really important subjective resource for people. We have a power of memory and heritage. Mark Freeman did a wonderful book called Hindsight, and he says that it produces self-understanding and it plays an integral role in shaping our moral life. I've done a number of interviews with children who've had very hard childhoods, and they get to their teens, and they use that past as a resource to say, actually, for example, when I grow up, I'm going to treat my kids differently from the way that I was treated, so you can learn from the past and move on, and decide to do things in a different way. And something really important here that I want to pull out is this notion of subjective understandings of causality. And I want to just say a little bit about the work of Laub and Sampson. They wrote a wonderful book with a wonderful title called Delinquent Boys Aged 70. Shared Beginnings, Divergent Lives, Delinquent Boys Aged 70. And this was a study of delinquent boys who grew up in Boston, probably in the 1930s. And when they got to 15 and they were in trouble with the police, there was a big study done on them, and they were measured and their educational records and police records reviewed and so on and so on. Very rich data set. I think there were about 200 in the sample. And then they were followed up again at the age of 25. And thereafter, I think this lovely rich data set languished somewhere in the attic. And Laub and Sampson came along many years later to find out what had happened to these delinquent boys. And they wrote a book in the 1980s, but this book, they were following up some of these men, finding out from their police records what was happening and so on. But then they were roundly criticised because they hadn't got the interior logic of these men's lives. So they took this on board and they went out and decided that they would do life history interviews with as many of the men as they could find. And that's what they wrote about in Shared Beginnings. And of course, what they were trying to do was to see, okay, over the life course, what led those men, some of them, to stick with a life of crime? But what led others of those men to go away from a life of crime? Now, it doesn't surprise me as a family sociologist to learn that things like family were what was one of the key factors that made a difference. But there were also confounding factors like alcoholism and so on. Employment was very important, of course, and very structured employment in the army, for example, you know, helped these men. But the key thing I want to draw out of this is that Laub and Sampson could not have possibly anticipated at the outset what would happen to any of those men. They could only understand the picture by constructing it backwards in time. And this is an old idea, it's the idea of Kierkegaard, who says, okay, we live our lives forward in time, but we can only actually understand it backwards. He goes on to say, if you think over that proposition, it becomes more and more evident that life can never really be understood in time, simply because at no particular moment can I find the necessary resting place from which to understand it. But what I would say to that is that that's what we as sociologists, as researchers, we can do that. We step back and we find the resting place in order to construct a story which is meaningful. Okay, just to go back then, just to say also, the past is never fixed. You might think it is, but it isn't. We overwrite and we reconstruct the past all the time from the vantage point of the ever-changing present. And I really like this quotation from one of the participants who took part in Molly Andrews' research. And you can find her work. She's a narrative researcher. And this participant said, when you look back, you see the path or paths that you've taken. The path would obviously not be so clear when you're groping up and finding it, would it? I mean, it's rather like going up a mountain. You're sort of looking that way and that track, and it looks too steep, and you're going around another one. Whereas when you're high up, you can look back and see it, and it sort of stands out much more clearly, things you didn't realise at the time. And if you think about it, you know, as you're going up along the path, every time you look back, you get a different view of the past. That's the point. So you reconstruct the past as you go along. Okay, that's a lot about the past, but I also want to say something about the future, because the future is so important, and it's very much a neglected field of research. And you can follow this up with the work of Barbara Adam, who's written a book called Future Matters with her colleague Chris Groves. Foresight. If we can understand the future, we can understand people's aspirations. We can understand the seeds of change. Who are those pioneers that go off in different directions and make things happen and change the world? So it's a really important thing. It's very important in policy context where people are supposed to be going to change their behaviour. But how do you get them to do that? How do you get people to, you know, find new aspirations and then put those aspirations into practice? Are those aspirations realistic or not? What they need to get there, and so on and so on. And again, how do we capture the future in our research? Well, we can use things like timelines, and we can ask people to write about the future, and then tease out in our interviews how they've constructed that future for themselves. And I just wanted to give you some examples from fieldwork data here. You might not be able to read this, but this is from the Young Lives and Times project, one of the Times States projects. At Leeds, and this is from Amelia, and at the age of 15 we asked all of these young people to write an essay about how they envisaged their life at the age of 25. And Amelia says, well, I finished my medicine course at university, I'm now training to be a forensic pathologist, I have a little green car which I use to get around. She talks about her flat and how she's going to move to Barcelona. She emails old friends and they update them with their lives. I'm writing stories in spiral-bound notebooks which litter the floor. The flat is clean as we keep it in good condition, and I take the train down to Leeds during the holidays and visit my family. Now, what we know from Amelia's interview is that this is an extremely realistic view of where she will be when she's 25. She's already on track to do precisely these things. She's already writing, she's already very well qualified, and so on and so on. Here's another another young person talking about how they envisage life at the age of 25. She says, I'm now a key stage one in year one class. I really enjoy it, and I enjoyed university when I was 18. And I went to Australia for a year, and it really matured me. And I'm now married with one child, and I want more than one child. And my husband and I live in a regular house and earn enough money to go abroad and buy our child toys. And she says, I enjoy life and love the family aspect, and I spend time with my family, and I'm lucky enough to still keep some friends, and so on. So she ends up by saying, she met her husband when she was 20, we married at 22, and I want 3 or 4 children, I'm still in touch with most of my family, and that's it really. Okay, but it's a very different kind of set of aspirations, which again you think are actually quite realistic for this person. And one of the interesting things was that Sophie's mum went off to Australia and had this big sort of flowering, you know, and then came back and got on with life. And that's partly where Sophie gets the idea. She'll do exactly the same. She'll go off travelling and then come back. I wanted to give you some examples of timelines. You know, you can construct them in so many different ways, but here's a young person who was born in 1993 and is constructing a timeline up to their current life at the age of 2007. The timeline is littered with important family events, the births of siblings, the deaths of people, an aunt who got married and so on. You can also see that this person has put on some historical events, like the knocking down of the Twin Towers. And then when we go back, we ask that person to project into the future and do a timeline there. And then we can see whether that trajectory actually materialises and why it may, or you know, what are the opportunities or constraints that get people there. Okay, that's another kind of timeline. This is a pretty empty one from a young person that hasn't really got much sense of where they've come from. That's quite interesting. I'm kind of getting towards the end now, but I just want to talk about some of the challenges of doing this style of research. It is a real challenge to maintain a sample over time. It's not just sample maintenance, it's sustaining relationships with people over time, which has a different sort of feel to it, really. And we do need to develop strategies for sample boosting. Although in my experience, and a lot of my colleagues, because of the way we work with people, they get very committed to doing this kind of research because we're validating their worldviews. And they want to maintain their involvement. Data collection is very eclectic, and we generate so much data. We started off in doing this kind of research, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. You always had to have at least 60 people in your sample, you know, to get funding. But now we're down to about 10, 10, 15. We can still get very rich accounts and answer our research questions with much smaller numbers of people because the volumes of data that we gather are huge. And that data may always have a provisional feel. There's always the next instalment in the story. So when do you bring the research to a close? When do you feel you've finished? These are some of the challenges. There are challenges of analysis, and it's very time-consuming. And what you're doing is proceeding in two directions simultaneously. If you like, you've got your cross-sectional analysis, which is repeated. Every time you're out in the field, you've got a cross-sectional analysis, looking across all your cases. And you have to do it after each wave, or you get no real muddle. And at the same time, you're building up your longitudinal case studies of individuals and what happens to them. Okay? And then you want an iteration between the two. So you need mechanisms to do it. One of the methods that we've been using more recently is a framework program. It's developed by Nat Sen, Richie and Lewis have written about it. And it's a very nice, simple grid system. You have a grid for each scene, and you have your vertical axis where your cases run, and at the top you have your time intervals, your waves of field work, and you can put your data into the grid so that you can, you know, it's creating a map of your data if you like. It's very useful. There are ethical considerations, very much the same if you like as the usual ethical considerations in qualitative research, but they're magnified because you're running over time. Consent is an ongoing process. There are all sorts of issues about maintaining boundaries around the researcher and research relationship. How do you bring the research to an end? You know, people sometimes get very dependent on you. One of our researchers in Timescapes are working in a very poor community, looking at grandparenthood in a community where the generations are very closely layered, very common for people to have children at the age of 15 or 16. And when she went out into the field, she would do things like sweep the floor and go and buy the milk. People can sit down and have a chat, you know, and that's the sort of involvement that you might find, and you have to manage it. And there's issues around, you know, if you're doing evaluation research or tracking policy context, you've got to be clear about the ethics of working with practitioners. Are we evaluating them? Are we providing a tool for them to evaluate themselves? These are important issues. But having sorted out some challenges, I just want to finish really by talking about the power of QR research. It is a very powerful tool for knowing and understanding the social world in a different way. We can discover the unimaginable through this method. And it can address some of the grand challenges of social science in our world of rapid social change. And just to paraphrase something that Barbara Adams said, when we start seeing things qualitatively through the lens of time, it quite simply changes it. So I hope you've enjoyed that journey through time. I'm very happy to take any questions or comments from you. Thank you very much.